Israel keeps up its deadly onslaught on the besieged Gaza Strip, with the death toll from the U.S.-Israeli genocide rising to over 34,000. The Iraqi military base housing PMU resistance fighters comes under a drone attack south of the capital, Baghdad. Some Iraqi officials blame the strike on Israel. U.S. police in New York raid a major pro-Palestine sit-in at Columbia University campus, arresting more than 100 students. This is news. Thanks for joining us. More Palestinians have lost their lives as the Israeli regime goes ahead with its genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Health Ministry has reported 37 deaths in Israel's indiscriminate airstrikes and shelling over the past 24 hours. New fatalities have pushed the death toll since the beginning of the war to over 34,000, mostly women and children. At least 76,900 Gazans have also been injured during the same period, while thousands remain unaccounted for. Palestinians in the besieged Strip are struggling to survive as the regime keeps blocking humanitarian aid. UN agencies have reported steep rise in malnutrition in Gaza. Health services are also on the brink of collapse, as only 12 out of 36 hospitals are partially functioning. The regime continued its genocidal campaign in Gaza, defying a global outcry. Meanwhile, the Israeli occupation forces have carried out fresh raids on several areas across the occupied West Bank. It includes the Nur Shams refugee camp near the city of Tulkarem, where at least 7 Palestinians have been killed since last night. The exchange of fire between Israeli regime forces and Hezbollah resistance movement continues in southern Lebanon, as tensions remain high over the regime's genocidal war against the Gaza Strip. The Lebanese resistance movement has launched several operations against Israeli positions in Hadap, Yarain, and in Mount Yarmouk, causing casualties. Regime forces also attacked residential areas in the Lebanese territories. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mayim Saleh, joined us earlier for more details.
The operations here have continued unabated. Hezbollah has proven, especially with the Israeli and U.S. pressure that is being put on Lebanon through diplomatic means. It seems Hezbollah is continuously basically targeting the Israelis, despite the fact that we have several days where Hezbollah tightens the noose and basically presses ahead with really significant, complex operations. At some times, there are routine operations. Today in the early morning, Hezbollah launched, as you said, an operation against the base of Hadab Yarin. And this is one of the bases. And it's a surprise to see that Hezbollah always finds something to target in those bases. Although some of them have been destroyed, their technological devices, their espionage devices, their radars, a lot of them have been destroyed. Hezbollah has also targeted a deployment of soldiers in the Mount of Adathir. Mount of Adathir is one of the series of mountains that are a part of the Jarmuk mountain. There is also the issue of the operation in Arab al-Jarmuk, Arab al-Aramisha, excuse me, which is was a significant operation recently. We know from Israeli media that at least 6 Israeli soldiers are still in very, very critical condition in hospital, and despite the fact that there is no disclosure of a number of soldiers, if they were dead or killed, but this was a very significant operation. The Israelis, of course, continue their shelling. Yesterday, they reached areas that are closer to the city of Tyre. Today, they are bombarding the heart of the towns of Kfar Kilab and Ait Shaab. These are residential areas, civilian houses that are being destroyed on a daily basis.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has fired drones at an Israeli position in the occupied territories following an early morning attack on an Iraqi military base. The umbrella group of Iraqi resistance factions has released a video of its attack, saying that they targeted a key location in the occupied port city of Eilat. The strike followed a drone attack on an Iraqi military base in the Babylon province. The base is jointly used by the Iraqi resistance group known as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU, the Iraqi Federal Police, and the Army. Some Iraqi officials blame the pre-dawn attack on Israel, although a PMU statement says that the U.S. was behind the incident. According to the chief security official in the Babylon province, there were 5 explosions at the base, leaving at least 1 person dead and several others injured. Usad Al-Matalabi, he's an Iraqi politician, and he joined us from Baghdad to tell us how the presence of American forces poses a big challenge to Iraq's stability and sovereignty.
Definitely, there's always the risk of security breaches when you have foreign forces on your soil. We don't know their aims, we don't know their targets, we don't know what the strategy they are holding being in Iraq. Are they using Iraq as a launching point for instability in the region? Are they using to destabilize the country like they did in 2019 when the American embassy and the American bases were very active in leading the demonstrations against the Iraqi government and the Iraqi democratic system? So the presence of these forces definitely contradict with the sovereignty and the security, the strategic security of the nation. The parliament, the biggest bloc that is leading the parliament at the moment, are determined that the Americans must leave. If the government, represented by Mr. Sudani, does not achieve this target, definitely the parliament will have a different view. The political parties which dominate the Iraqi parliament has already declared their intention. They're already declared that the Americans must leave. Not only the Americans, all foreign fighting forces must leave the country. This issue is already in discussion. I'm sure that with the return of the Prime Minister from the United States, the Prime Minister will be informed of the results of these meetings, of this committee, and the dates and method for the Americans to leave Iraq will be declared. But definitely they are going to leave. We have taken the decision. The decision has been taken by the Parliament and the people of Iraq that the Americans must leave.
U.S. police have detained more than 100 pro-Palestinian students staging a sitting on the campus of New York's Columbia University. The police clamped down on the protesters and cleared an encampment set up by students demonstrating against Israel's war in Gaza. Several students involved in the protests were also suspended from the university. They include Isra Hirsi, who is the daughter of Ilhan Omar, a Democrat in the U.S. House of Representatives. University professor Joseph Howley has criticized the move, saying the university responded to how the students were protesting, rather than what they were protesting for. Meanwhile, the students returned to the school premises in defiance and in protest against the university policies. Since the onset of the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, universities across the U.S. have seen a rise in protests and civil disobedience. An Israeli far-right minister has come under fire for posting the word lame on social media platform X after the regime's alleged operation inside of Iran. We discussed the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Welcome everyone to the news review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. An Israeli far-right minister has drawn strong criticism for posting the word lame on social media platform X after regime's alleged operation inside of Iran. Israeli opposition leader Yair Lapid says posts by War Cabinet member Ben-Gvir has done heavy damage to Israel's security, its image, and international status. Lapid says Ben-Gvir managed to get Israel mocked and shamed all the way from Tehran to Washington. Also, Israeli media quoted unnamed officials close to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, slamming the minister's comments as childish and irrelevant. On Friday, Iran's army said the air defenses in the central city of Isfahan fired at suspicious objects. However, no damage was reported. An informed source said Iran's air defenses shot down 3 quadcopters over the city. And now joining us for the program is Fra Hughes, journalist, author, and activist, joining us out of Rome, and Barry Grossman, international lawyer, joining us from Bali, Indonesia. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you to joining us on the program here. Hope you're both doing well. I guess we'll start there in Rome with you, Fra. These divisions that we have seen actually growing deeper and deeper by the day in Israeli society. How deep do you see them from your perspective, and what kind of impact do you think they will have on Tel Aviv's politics moving forward?
Well, I'm not sure what we're witnessing is anything other than a public spat in the public domain for public consumption within Israel. That he believes that Israel has not responded forthrightly, it hasn't responded forcibly, and it has shown its weakness to the whole world. On one level, I am pleased that if this is the actual Israeli response, then perhaps no further action will be required by the Iranian armed services. And perhaps a new deterrent has been created in the region, whereby the Israeli war cabinet, filled with war criminals, will have to think twice before they kill anyone, anywhere, at any time in the region if Iran will choose to retaliate. But we need to see where this will all go as we move forward, because Israeli society cares nothing for the lives of Palestinians. It cares nothing for the lives of Iranians, and we have to see whether or not they have finally been reined in, not by America, not by the UK, not by the EU, but by Iran.
Thank you, Fra, and very gross and welcome to the program.
What we're seeing here is criticism of him, not because he was indeed appointed in the first place to occupy this very important strategic position as Minister of Security for the occupation, but rather because he dared to criticize the Biden administration and suggested that the occupation would do better negotiating with the new President Trump. There are not people lining up to condemn this 7-time convicted criminal. He was indicted 53 times. His name first became public when he'd stolen the hood ornament off of Yitzhak Rabin's Cadillac and threatened that he and his light-thinking cohorts would get to Rabin too, not long before Rabin was assassinated. The criticism isn't concerned with all of this, let alone with his position of support for Zionist and settler terrorism, retaking Gaza and expelling Palestinians and restricting their movement and everything. That's not what the concern is about. The concern is about what his comments might do to relations between the executive branch in the United States and the Knesset and the security agencies of the occupation. But let's never forget that even Obama, who once took issue with Netanyahu during his first term, came back much later and said, look, as the president, Congress is largely controlled by AIPAC, and if you dissent, you won't remain president for very long. So they're not concerned in Israel about any criticism directed at the Biden administration or any enthusiasm for a potential new Trump administration.
Gentlemen, time has gotten better for us, but I want to thank you both for joining us on the program, and stay safe to both of you. As Fra Hughes there joining us from Rome, Italy, and international lawyer Barry Grossman joining us out of Bali, Indonesia. This brings us to the conclusion of this segment of your news review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The United States has announced the withdrawal of its forces from Niger, ending its over a decade-long military presence in the West African country. The decision came after a meeting of the U.S. Deputy Secretary of State with Niger's Prime Minister on Friday. A delegation of U.S. officials is set to visit Niamey to arrange the withdrawal of troops that were deployed under the pretext of fighting terrorism in Niger. Nigerians have held numerous protest rallies in recent months to demand their government expel foreign troops, including Americans. Niger's former colonizer, France, pulled out its forces at the end of 2023, but about 1,000 U.S. soldiers remained in the African country. Anti-U.S. sentiment has been running high in Niger following a coup that overthrew the government of President Mohamed Bazoum last year. And that does it for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Eight deliveries have become known as death traps in the Gaza Strip. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, aid deliveries have become known as death traps in Gaza. Karam al-Shawa understands why. On February 29th, he witnessed the flour bag massacre. The Zionist regime opened fire on Palestinians waiting for food on Al-Rashid Street, southwest of Gaza City, that day. As a result, 118 people were killed. Karam had been among the crowds. He and his friend Muhammad had retreated from the scene once they heard a warning to disperse from an Israeli troop. Soon after they had begun to move away, they saw the Israeli regime military attacking the crowd. The horrific incident convinced Karam that queuing for aid was too dangerous. Yet a few days later, he found himself running toward a place where, according to news spread by word of mouth, flour was available in tons. As his family had nothing left to eat, Karam felt that collecting a small amount of flour was necessary. He said, "Unfortunately, some of us were too late. I saw people desperately taking some flour from the ground. The flour was mixed with sand, but these people felt it was better to take it than to go back to their families empty-handed." Karam has observed some of the most terrible incidents in the Zionist regime's current genocidal war. His home was near Ashrafa, Gaza's largest hospital. When Israeli regime troops besieged the hospital in March, having previously attacked it on several occasions, Karam felt that he was living through a non-stop nightmare. He was extremely worried about what could happen to his sister and their mother, particularly when the Zionist regime military seized a building across from where they lived. As far as the Al-Shawa family could see, the Israeli regime forces started using that building for coordination purposes during the siege of Ashrafa and its environs. On March 20, the family had an extremely tough night. It was Ramadan, and although they had been fasting all day, they had no appetite in the evening. They just broke their fast with some water and dates, Karam said. The sound of gunfire from the Israeli occupation was deafening. Karam learned that the Israelis had broken into the home of his uncle who lived next door. Manal, Karam's mother, hastily grabbed her own family's cash and jewelry with the aim of hiding it from the Israeli regime forces. The following morning, the family tried to contact Karam's uncle but could not reach him. They then went to his house once they were sure that the Zionist regime troops were no longer in it. Karam said, "I was shocked by the condition of the house. There wasn't a single spot on the walls that didn't have a bullet hole." It took almost a day before the family managed to get any news from Karam's uncle. When the Israelis broke into his home, they ordered that he leave it. Several days later, Israeli regime troops again entered their street in tank. With gunfire nearby, the six family members got down on the floor in their apartment. They crawled between rooms and sought to keep some distance from the windows. Soon the family could hear that the Israeli regime troops had broken into apartments in the same building. The family had heard various pieces of advice about how to respond if faced by Israeli regime troops. The advice was to be submissive or risk fatal consequences. Rad Karam's father has a good knowledge of Hebrew. He learned the language after making frequent visits to Israel for treatment after being diagnosed with cancer in 2007. When Rad heard that the Zionist regime troops were very close, he stood behind the door and spoke in a loud voice. He said, "We are civilians, a family of six. Myself, my wife, three sons and a daughter. Should I open the door?" After Rad opened the door, the troops took him outside the apartment. They ordered him to sit on the floor with his hands raised. The troops then instructed the other members of the family to leave the apartment one by one. Everyone complied apart from Majed, the eldest son. Majed, who has cerebral palsy, was extremely afraid and refused to move. His father, Rad, tried to tell the troops that Majed has a medical condition. He would not move because of fear, not because he wished to disobey, Rad explained. The troops split the family in two. Majed, his sister Entesar, and their mother were held in the living room. Karam, his younger brother Amr, and their father were taken to the kitchen. "They told us to take off our clothes," Karam said, adding, "A soldier came over to me and took my ID. After a humiliating search, they made us kneel with our hands in the air." The troops went through the apartment. They found a box of spent bullets. The family had collected the bullets from the streets after the Zionist regime forces had carried out an earlier ground invasion. Karam said, "The soldiers aimed their weapons at my father's head, and I was struck with the back of another weapon." The Israeli regime troops accused the family of storing arms for Hamas. Rad Karam's father sought to assure them that the bullets were already spent and that they had actually been fired by the Zionist regime troops. But the troops continued to behave aggressively. The Zionist regime troops then tied up the hands of the three men in the kitchen and blindfolded them. They were forced to stand facing the wall for about an hour, during which the troops searched the apartment another time. The men were taken to the first floor of the building. They and members of another family were ordered to hand over their IDs for inspection. Karam was unable to comply with that order because the same troop giving the order had already taken his ID and not returned it. Karam said, "The soldier denied that he had taken the ID and accused me of lying." When the Zionist regime soldier asked Karam for his identity number, Karam could not provide it as he had not memorized it. He had never needed to memorize it previously. The soldier then asked him for his name 10 consecutive times. After Karam had repeated his full name 10 times, the soldier gave him back his ID. Before that moment, the family had resolved to remain in Gaza City. Now they were given no choice than to leave for the south. They were told that they would have to be naked for the waist up as they evacuated. The soldiers tried to claim that the measure was for their own safety. It would make clear to Israeli troops along the way that they were civilians. They were then brought to the entrance of the building. There, they found Karam's brother Majed, along with the female members of their family and a neighboring family, sitting on the floor. The Israeli regime troops gave them a number of torches. One of the torches was placed on Karam's head. The troops warned them that they must follow the demarcated route. Deviating from it would result in them being shot.
Ocean of Dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful Hello everyone, brothers and sisters I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program The Ocean of Dua In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss. فَإِنَّكَ قَضَيْتَ عَلَىٰ عِبَادِكَ بِعِبَادَتِكَ وَأَمَرْتَهُمْ بِدُعَائِكَ وَضَمِنْتَ لَهُمُ الْإِجَابَةِ Brothers and sisters, we have reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail supplication. فَإِنَّكَ قَضَيْتَ عَلَىٰ عِبَادِكَ بِعِبَادَتِكَ You have decreed your worship for your servants. وَأَمَرْتَهُمْ بِدُعَائِكَ You commanded them to supplicate you. وَضَمِنْتَ لَهُمُ الْإِجَابَةِ You assured them that they would be answered. فَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّي نَصَبْتُ وَجْهِي So toward you, my Lord, I have turned my face. وَإِلَيْكَ يَا رَبِّي مَدَدْتُ يَدِي And toward you, my Lord, I have extended my hand. Regarding the acceptance of prayers and supplications, we said in the previous episode that there are different necessary conditions to be met for the acceptance of prayers. And when the Almighty Allah says, "Ujibu da'wat ad-da'i idha da'an," I answer surely the prayer of the supplicant when he calls on me, it is based on different conditions and prerequisites. And those conditions are to be found in the different verses of the Holy Quran and even in the traditions of Ahlul Bayt. It is narrated, for example, that the Israelis were affected by famine for 7 years. 70,000 of them went to a desert to pray for rain. Now, in that situation, there came a divine address, O Moses, say to them, how should I accept your prayer while your sins have embraced you and your hearts are covered with evil? Do you call upon me while you do not believe in me? Go to one of my servants named Burkh so that he would ask me and I would accept it. Moses looked for that man, but he could not find him. One day, he was passing a place where he saw a black slave on whose forehead was the sign of prostration and who had hung something on his neck. Moses, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam, thought that he was Burkh, so he asked him of his name. He answered, I am. My name is Burkh. Moses said, I have been looking for you for a while. Pray for rain. That man went to the desert and said in his prayers, O Allah, withholding the rain from your servants is below your dignity. There is no stinginess in your presence. Is it that your mercy is weakened, or that the winds have disobeyed you, or your resources have terminated, or your wrath to the sinners has increased? Were you not the forgiver before creating the sinners? He had not even moved from his place, the tradition says, when it started to rain, to that extent that all the Israelis' thirst was quenched.
Verily, you have ordained for your servants your worship, and bidden them to supplicate unto you, and have assured them of your response. So, my Lord, I look earnestly towards you, and towards you, my Lord, I have stretched forth my hands. Therefore, by your honor, respond to my prayers, and let me attain my wishes. And by your bounty, frustrate not my hopes, and protect me from the evils of my enemies, from among the jinns and mankind.
Thank you, Allah, that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Dear listeners, even in this tradition of the Ahlul Bayt, and the story of Prophet Moses, ala nabina wa alihi wa alihi salam, you can see that the supplication of the man is accepted by the Almighty Allah, and the supplication of all those people are not accepted because of one small nuance, one small important point. The point is that those people who went to the desert to pray for rain had their sins with them. They, as the Almighty Allah said to Moses, how should I accept your prayer while your sins have embraced you? They had committed so many sins that their hearts were covered with evil. So the Almighty Allah says, I do not accept such supplication. But now let us have a look at the supplication of this man, Burkh. At first, he began his supplication by naming him. O Allah, this means, O Allah, I have recognized who you are. I have known your attributes. I have known where I'm standing. I know my position and yours too. I know where and I know from whom I'm asking. So he continued, O Allah, withholding the rain from your servants is below your dignity. This means he knows that he is one of the servants of the Almighty Allah. He knows one of the great attributes of the Almighty Allah, which is his dignity. So he names them. Naming these attributes out loud is one of those conditions. Then he moves on. There is no stinginess in your presence. This means he knows the Almighty Allah's attributes completely, and that's why he has come to him to supplicate. That's why he knows the Almighty Allah as the forgiver before creating the sinners. This causes the Almighty Allah to accept the supplication, and this is how they get rain, enough rain to the extent that their thirst is quenched. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website, at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you through all my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
There was no call by Western leaders for restraint as Israel bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure Israel has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Middle East Eye wrote, suddenly Western politicians from U.S. President Joe Biden to British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak have become ardent champions of restraint in a very last-minute scramble to avoid regional conflagration. Iran launched a salvo of drones and missiles at Israel in a retaliatory move. The United Nations Security Council was hurriedly pressed into session, with Washington and its allies calling for a de-escalation of tensions that all could too easily lead to the outbreak of war across the West Asia region and beyond. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the meeting, neither the region nor the world can afford more war. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. The Zionist regime, meanwhile, vowed to exact the price against Iran at the time of its choosing, but the West's abrupt conversion to restraint needs some explaining. After all, Western leaders showed no restraint when the Zionist regime bombed Iran's consulate in Damascus, killing a senior general and more than a dozen other Iranians, the proximate cause of Tehran's retaliation. Under the Vienna Convention, the consulate is not only a protected diplomatic mission, but is viewed as sovereign Iranian territory. The Zionist regime's attack on it was an unbridled act of aggression, the supreme international crime, and the Nuremberg Tribunal ruled at the end of the Second World War. For that reason, Tehran invoked Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, which allows it to act in self-defense. And yet, rather than condemning the Zionist regime's dangerous belligerence, a flagrant attack on the so-called rules-based order, so revered by the U.S., Western leaders lined up behind Washington's favorite client state. At a Security Council meeting on April 4th, the U.S., Britain, and France intentionally spurned restraint by blocking a resolution that would have condemned Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate, a vote that, had it not been stymied, might have sufficed to placate Tehran. Recently, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron still gave the thumbs up to Israel's flattening of Iran's diplomatic premises, saying he could completely understand the frustration Israel feels, though, he added, without any hint of awareness of his own hypocrisy, that the UK would take very strong action if a country bombed a British consulate. By shielding the Zionist regime from any diplomatic consequences for its acts of war against Iran, the Western powers, in short Tehran, would have to pursue a military response instead. But it did not end there. Having stoked Iran's sense of grievance at the UN, Biden vowed ironclad support for the Israeli regime and grave consequences for Tehran should it dare to respond to the attack on its consulate. Iran ignored those threats. Recently, it launched hundreds of drones and missiles at the same time, protesting vociferously about the Security Council's inaction and silence, coupled with its failure to condemn the Israeli regime's aggressions. And Western leaders failed to take note. They again sided with Israel and denounced Tehran. At the recent Security Council meeting, the same three states, the US, the UK, and France, that had earlier blocked a statement condemning the Zionist regime's attack on Iran's diplomatic mission, sought a formal condemnation of Tehran for its response. Russia's ambassador to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, ridiculed what he called the parade of Western hypocrisy and double standards. You know very well that an attack on a diplomatic mission is a casus belli under international law. And if Western missions were attacked, you would not hesitate to retaliate and prove your case in this room. There was no restraint visible either as the West publicly celebrated its collusion with Israel in foiling Iran's attack and thereby effectively making itself a direct party to this dangerous confrontation. The restraint the West demands relates only, it seems, to Iran's efforts to defend itself. Given the West's newfound recognition of the need for caution and the obvious dangers of military excess, now may be the time for its leaders to consider demanding restraint more generally and not just to avoid a further escalation between Iran and the child-killing regime of Israel. Over the past 6 months, the Zionist regime has bombed Gaza into rubble, destroyed its medical facilities and government offices, and martyred and maimed many, many tens of thousands of Palestinians. In truth, such is the devastation that Gaza some time ago lost the ability to count its dead and wounded. At the same time, the Zionist regime has intensified its 17-year blockade of the tiny enclave to the point where so little food and water are getting through. The population are in the grip of famine. People, especially children, are literally starving to death. The International Court of Justice, the world's highest court, chaired by an American judge, ruled back in January, when the situation was far less dire than it is now, that a plausible case had been made the Zionist regime was committing genocide, a crime against humanity strictly defined in international law. And yet, there were no calls by Western leaders for restraint as the Zionist regime bombed Gaza into ruins week after week, striking its hospitals, leveling its government offices, blowing up its universities, mosques, and churches, and destroying its bakeries. Rather, President Biden has repeatedly rushed through emergency arms sales, bypassing Congress to make sure the Zionist regime has enough bombs to keep destroying Gaza and killing its children. When the Zionist regime leaders vowed to treat Gaza's population like human animals, denying them all food, water, and power, Western politicians gave their assent. Sunak was not interested in recruiting his brave RAF pilots to protect civilians in Gaza from Israel, and Starmer showed no concern about the fear and instability felt by Palestinians from Israel's reign of terror. Quite the reverse. Starmer, famed as a human rights lawyer, even gave his approval to Israel's collective punishment of the people of Gaza, its complete siege, as integral to a supposed Israeli right of self-defense. In doing so, he overturned one of the most fundamental principles of international law, that civilians should not be targeted for the actions of their leaders. As is now all too apparent, he confirmed a death sentence on the people of Gaza. Where was restraint then? Similarly, restraint went out of the window when Israel fabricated a pretext for eradicating the UN agency UNRWA, the last lifeline for Gaza's starving population. Even though the Zionist regime was unable to offer any evidence for its claim that a handful of UNRWA staff were implicated in an attack on Israel on October 7th, Western leaders hurriedly cut off funding to the agency. In doing so, they became actively complicit in what the World Court already feared was a genocide. Where was the restraint when Israeli officials, with a long history of lying to advance their regime's military agenda, made up stories about Hamas beheading babies or carrying out systematic rapes on October 7th? All of this was debunked by an Al Jazeera investigation drawing largely on the Israeli sources. Those genocide-justifying deceptions were all too readily amplified by Western politicians and media. The Zionist regime showed no restraint in destroying Gaza's hospitals or taking hostage and torturing thousands of Palestinians it grabbed off the street. All of that got a quiet nod from Western politicians. Where was the restraint in Western capitals when protesters took to the streets to call for a ceasefire, to stop Israel's bloodletting of women and children, the majority of Gaza's dead? The demonstrators were smeared, are still smeared by Western politicians as supporters of terrorism and anti-Semites. And where was the demand for restraint when the child-killing regime of Israel tore up the rule book on the laws of war, allowing every would-be strong man to cite the West's indulgence of Israeli atrocities as the precedent justifying their own crimes? On each occasion, when it favored Israel's malevolent goals, the West's commitment to restraint went missing in action.
ربنا Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
ربنا يا ربنا يا ربنا يا حي ويا قيوم نور قلبنا.
You are listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining a very important question. That question is related to one of our most central and important pillars of our Islamic faith. I am referring specifically to prophethood, which we call in Arabic Nubuwwat. So, as you know, prophethood, it means the delegation of messengers by God who are given knowledge, a specific type of knowledge, which we call wahi or revelation, for guidance. Now, sometimes this revelation is meant for guidance of others, sometimes it's just meant for the guidance of that prophet in particular. So the question that we want to ask today about this subject is this: what is the philosophy or the reasoning behind prophethood and the delegation of prophets. There are, fortunately, a number of hadiths and Quranic verses as well, which allude to some of the reasons why God delegated the prophets and sent them and, you know, revealed his knowledge to them. One of the reasons for the delegation of prophethood is perfection, the perfection of human beings. In response to an atheist who asked him, "Wherefore did you establish the need for and existence of prophets?" Imam Sadiq alayhi salam said the following: "When we establish that we have a creator and maker, supreme over us and over all that he created, and that this maker is so wise and supreme that his creation cannot see him or touch him, like they can mutually see each other and contend with each other, it hence becomes established that he has ambassadors among his creation who speak on his behalf to his creation and servants." In this beautiful hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that in reality, the necessity of prophethood stems from our understanding that, you know, there's a God who created us and who is wise. He couldn't have created us without a purpose, and he knows that purpose better than we do. However, he's not a physical being. We cannot have physical contact with him, obviously. So God, he has to send a person or a being who is similar to us and can communicate with us, you know, face to face, so that he can send that message of how to attain that that purpose for which we have been created. This is the reason why prophets were delegated and sent. In continuation, the Imam alayhi salam says the following: "They," meaning the prophets, "guide creation to their advantages and benefits." These prophets, they tell them what is to their advantage, what is to their benefit, and to that which will secure their survival and that which will destroy them. He tells them and informs them what will lead to their perpetuity both in this world and in the hereafter, right? So in essence, the reason for prophethood, it stems from certain qualities and features of Allah. The fact that he created us, the fact that he is wise and he has a purpose in his creation, and also the fact that he's not physical or corporeal, he's immaterial. These lead to and the fact that he wants to, you know, tell us what is to our benefit and what is not to our benefit. This leads to the necessity of prophethood. In essence, we want to sum it up in one word, we can say that prophethood is for our perfection and our betterment. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what the philosophy of prophethood is in the light of the Hadith and Quran. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key, an IRIB English radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.